Welcome back to Techonomics. I am your host, Jason Middleton. This week, we are sticking closer to a theme, and that theme is citizen science. These supercomputers that we all carry around in our pockets, called smartphones, well, they have a tremendous potential for collecting, identifying, and sharing, well, just about anything, really. For this week's show, though, we are going to bypass the selfie phenomenon and go right to scientific research. With apps like iNaturalist and projects like Nature's Notebook, anyone can help trained and dedicated researchers collect much-needed data from around the country. That big data collection then leads to efforts like drought reduction or the slowing of species extinctions. One of several such projects is out of Cornell University. The subjects involved here are no less than trees and water. Mega droughts may become more commonplace as the Earth heats up, and the need for data is increasing around this. And why? Because state-of-the-art global climate models, quote, do not capture this characteristic of hydroclimate variability, end quote. Okay, that's science speak, for citizen scientists can help us with more data as we try to crack this mega drought code. Here's our chat with just such a researcher.
Professor Toby Ault at Cornell University.
I talked with Mary Ellen Hannibal a couple of weeks ago, and she got me very, very interested, not in only in her book, but she mentioned you by name, and she mentioned a couple of other projects as well. So I've been using iNaturalist as an app with my seven-year-old on the weekends, and we've been identifying some things in our gardens, and she's really already intrigued. Yours is a little, of course, higher level than that. I'd like to talk about a few of your adventures, if you will, in research. But let's start at the beginning. Citizen science as a research tool for someone of your expertise, is that highly valuable, somewhat valuable, or a growing field?
I would say it's a growing field that is going to become invaluable. And the reason is that it's, citizen science is a tool for making measurements of things that can only be observed by other humans. And until this era that we're living in with big data, we didn't really know how to use that tool. Now that we can collate and assemble information from millions and millions of observers, we can really learn a lot more about the planet we're living on than has ever been possible before.
Very cool. It's almost like having minions you can send out to give you decent data, I hope.
I think of it as, I guess, minions seems to me, I don't know, a little bit too one-sided. I guess I don't like the term minions because I think of it as more of a conversation. And the technology that exists today lets us have that conversation between the scientific world and the world of the observers who are out there in the field and seeing things happen in real time.
Fair enough, Professor Ault. I'll change the diction on that one. But let's talk about one of your conversations you're having.
The annual growth of trees is something that every elementary school child recognizes. It's, you know, often hailed as the hallmark or the very imprint of the passage of time. And it turns out that each year when trees grow, if environmental conditions are right, they record some climatic information. And that climatic information can then be used to make inferences about temperature and precipitation changes in the past. And that's a large part of what we do. We then compare those temperature and precipitation changes in the past to the global climate model simulations we do to understand the nature of climate variability, climatic fluctuations through time, and climate change.
Let's zoom out just a little bit and focus on the word mega drought for a moment.
Sure.
I live out here on the West Coast. I'm a transplant from the East Coast. So what are you seeing when it comes to so far, and this can be anecdotal, about mega drought in the West?
Well, we know that mega droughts have happened in the past, and we know that from tree ring records. And we see very strong evidence now that the risk of those events occurring again because of climate change is much higher than it's been in the past. A mega drought in our work has been defined as a period of aridity lasting 35 years or longer. That's a generation-long drought. And in the tree ring record, those events have only occurred at a rate of maybe once or twice per millennium. So per 1,000 years, you maybe would have one or two megadroughts. During climate change, if it goes unmitigated, unabated, the risk of those events in the West and in the Southwest could be as high as 70 or 80%.
Oh, that sounds rather ominous. What are the chances of mega drought for the rest of this century?
They're about that high unless we get serious about our mitigation strategies to stop using the atmosphere as a dumping ground for waste carbon.
Yeah, let's tease that out a little bit. Out here in California, our governor, Jerry Brown, has referred to climate deniers as troglodytes. We are relying on you, Professor Alton, people like you, to help us understand how to mitigate. Are there some broad strokes you can help us with?
I think every little bit counts. I always say all of the above when I'm presented with what mitigation options should we be pursuing. I usually say all of the above because we're not sure which ones are going to be the most successful. California is clearly playing an important role. Moving away from fossil fuels and using alternative sources of energy is a critical step forward. California is showing a lot of leadership, and they who are in the legislature and you who live there and the citizens, residents of California, are, of course, to be congratulated for paving the way for sensible and realistic mitigation strategies. And it comes down to good policy, and it comes down to personal choice, and we can be more judicious as consumers about the kinds of products that we use and the way that we make or the way that we consume energy will, I think, shape how effectively we can address the climate change challenge.
As you are collecting your data for research and for analysis and whatnot, can we speak a little bit to the tools that you have at hand, maybe some of the technology you rely on to help
Sure.
you with that? And we could talk about that in a citizen science way as well as just in a purely laboratory kind of way.
I rely on three disparate sources of data primarily. One is the citizen science data that is collected and has been collected in some cases for decades now by observers. And that data is really useful for trying to characterize plant responses to the start of spring. I also use observational data, which I would put in that category. I would include tree ring measurements along with instrumental records and other types of direct observations of temperature and precipitation in the past. And then the third type of data that I use comes from global climate model simulations. And those data sets can be really tremendous, really very, very large. Those data sets can be on the order of terabytes or even petabytes.
Wow, that's a lot of data. We are speaking with Toby Ault. He is an assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Cornell University. Professor Ault, my last question for you is a bit, again, anecdotal, if you will indulge me, please. I cover business and technology, and not necessarily science, but one of the business jargon things I've always seen and always heard is mission creep. Now, I'm noticing that one of your talks that you've given before and probably will again has to do with season or seasonal creep, and I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about that because, and here's why, at my house, my azaleas are confused, and they seem to want to bloom more than their seasonal genetics would probably imply, and then my Japanese maple, however, is equally confused but still only sheds its leaves once a year. Am I looking at seasonal creep in my own garden?
The warmer temperatures we're seeing, especially in spring and then well into the fall, are making it possible for both the kinds of species that we like to see and the kind of species that we don't like to see to have longer life cycles, to be more active for more of the warm season. So you might see, you know, lilacs earlier and earlier in the spring. And spring could also be characterized by the arrival of birds and bugs and all the critters that we love to welcome to the northern latitudes as spring starts. On the other hand, it can mean longer and longer growing seasons for weeds and for invasive species. Certain insects might be able to squeeze in an extra few generations so that when they start reproducing in April, they're able to have numbers that are really damaging and really challenging for ecosystems and agriculture alike. So there's definitely a lot of seasonal creep happening. The length of the warm season is extending in virtually all of North America, but it cuts both ways.
I see. Well, Professor Ault, thank you much for the call for action, as well as for all the work you've been doing on this. Much obliged. And let's speak again when you have more results, okay?
Great. Thank you, Jason.
That was Toby Ault, assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Cornell University. We have links in two places for his research on droughts, trees, and other projects. First, try facebook.com/techonomicsradio. And you can also check out kgoradio.com/techonomics for more on Professor Ault's research, as well as a link to this entire segment. Coming up after this next break, we pivot from data collection to data distribution, that is, new consumer tech hardware from Google. I'm Jason Middleton. This is Techonomics. Please stay tuned.